Welcome to the Well Podcast. We hope that this message will help you grow in your faith and give you practical ways to strengthen your relationships. To find out more, visit thewell.ca. Several years ago, when I was making the decision to leave a career in business and become the pastor of this church, the question I got the most was, what kind of church is it? And I think that that question wasn't simply about denominational identifier or shape of the building, which I told them was a UFO movie theater. It was more like, people still go to church? Like there was kind of a curiosity and a bit of surprise. Are you too young to be a priest? I got that. I looked much younger then. Those kind of questions. And sometimes, if I'm honest, people would ask it not just out of curiosity, but sometimes out of cynicism or skepticism or criticism. Like one of the conversations we had with the municipality at one point about land and zoning, and they kind of were saying, I think they actually said this directly, well, does this city really need any more churches? You know, what kind of church is it? And more like, not like I'm curious, I'm more skeptical, like why, what's the point? Maybe you've had that experience before where, in fact, if you're new, maybe one of the questions you've asked or you're asking today is, oh, what kind of church is this? Like, what's this really about? What's this community like? Maybe you've had people in your life when they find out that you go to church, it's a little bit of a, oh, people still go to church? I mean, should I go to church? What kind of church is it? And possibly you yourself, or maybe people in your life ask that kind of question with a little bit of cynicism or skepticism or criticism, right? It's like, well, what kind of church is it? And do we really need churches like that anymore? Well, you may not know this, especially if you're new, but this is we're heading into or actually completing our 20th year as a church. This October the 5th, is our 20th anniversary. We're 20. And I thought it would be a great time. In fact, my team and I, as we were talking about how we want to mark this season as a church, we thought all through this fall, it'd be a great thing to kind of come back to our vision as a church, who we're meant to be. And in some ways, at the beginning here of September, answer this question for you. What kind of church is this? If you're new, that you might be able to kind of have a sense of like, okay, wow, like, that's what I'm joining. If you're a part of this community and you've been a part of this community for a while, that it would be kind of a revisioning or a re-engaging with this idea of what the church is. And so we are, in a sense, starting a series this fall that we've called the Well DNA. What are we about? And one of the things I've been saying to our staff all the way through this is, as we've been thinking about, oh, we're 20 this year as a church, is like, I have a 20-year-old in my household. 20-year-olds don't spend a lot of time on their birthdays looking back and reflecting. They're looking ahead. All of life, in a sense, is ahead of them. They are coming of age. And while we definitely want to, at this stage, kind of look back on 20 years and reflect on God's goodness to us, especially because for any of you that were part of planting this, you might remember one of the statistics that the planting pastor quoted to us was 9 out of 10 new churches fail. It's like, great. And so even to be where we are 20 years later, we want to be so thankful to God that he has given us this thriving community as a church. But we want to actually be looking ahead and saying, well, what kind of church are we and are we going to be? How has God uniquely called us to be as a church? And I'm hoping that as we answer that question for you, it will be a beautiful answer. Not just one that, if you are new, would help you figure out what kind of church we are. Not just one that maybe would give you words to describe to other people, you know, why you go to church and what this means to you. But something beautiful in the sense that others might say, oh, I think I'd like to try that. I think I'd like to experience that. One that, if I can say this, will be beautiful for any of us that have had hurt from churches or the church in the past, that this would be a healing conversation for you, a restoring conversation, a conversation that gives you a vision to say, oh yeah, I want to be a part of what this community is about, whether this is day one for you or you've been here the whole 20 years. And I was thinking about where would I want to start this conversation or this series? My mind went to a conversation that Jesus had with someone. And initially, for many years, I read this conversation in one of the biographies of Jesus as more like a conversation between Jesus and someone who had made a lot of bad decisions in their life, and Jesus was being very gracious and kind to them, because that's what Jesus does. And of course, he is being gracious in this conversation, as we'll see. But I've now realized over the years, and actually thinking about it again for this message, that is not at all what was going on. Jesus was doing something far more profound and something far more powerful. And I want us to listen in on this conversation because it's a perfect starting point, in a sense, to answer the question. It's not Jesus having a conversation with someone saying, what kind of church is it? Because he hadn't started the church yet. But it was actually a conversation that Jesus was having for someone who's saying, well, what kind of man is Jesus? What kind of person are you, Jesus? And what kind of God is God? And in this conversation, it's someone who is curious, but skeptical, cynical, and critical. And normally we would read the text from the passage of scripture that we're going to look at. But today I actually want you to watch it. This is an articulation of this conversation that Jesus had recorded for us in John's biography through a TV series called The Chosen. And a good chunk of the whole passage in conversation in John chapter 4 is actually articulated here verbatim. And then there's some added color to help us understand what might this context have even been like, since we're talking about a conversation that happened 2,000 years ago. So I invite you to watch that now.
Would you give me a drink? Did you hear me?
That bad, huh?
What?
You, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a Samaritan, and a woman.
I'm sorry. I should have said please.
You know, it's not safe for you to be alone out here.
Nor you. Why haven't you come with others? Why so late in the day? Don't women come to the wells in the cool of the morning?
Yeah, well, none of them will be seen with me, so I have to come at noon, in the heat, as you have so kindly reminded me.
Why won't they be seen with you?
Long story.
I'd still like a drink of water, if you can spare it.
Amazing what a parched throat will do. Aren't I unclean to you? Won't you be defiled by this vessel?
Maybe some of my people say that about your women, but I don't.
Yeah? And what do you say?
I say if you knew who I am, you'd be asking me for a drink.
Really?
And I would give you living water.
Would. Except that you have nothing to draw water with, and this is a deep well. Besides, what do you need from me if you have your own supply of living water?
Long story.
But Jewish water is better than Samaritan water. Hmm?
That's not what I said.
Are you a better man than our ancestor Jacob, who dug this well? Your water is better than his?
I know Jacob. And everyone who drinks this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks the water that I give him will never be thirsty again.
Wouldn't that be nice?
The water I give will become in a person a spring of water welling up to eternal life.
Really?
Yes, really.
Prove it.
First, go and call your husband and come back. I will show you both.
I don't have a husband.
You are right. You've had 5 husbands. And the man you're living with now is not your husband.
Oh, I see. You're a prophet. You're here to preach at me.
No.
Usually the one good thing about coming here alone is I can escape being condemned.
I'm not here to condemn you.
I've made mistakes. Too many. But it's men like you who have made it impossible for me to do anything about it.
How?
Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain. But you Jews insist Jerusalem is the only place for true worship.
They say that because the temple is there.
Exactly where we're not allowed.
I'm here to break those barriers. And the time is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father.
So, where am I supposed to go when I need God? I've never received anything from God, but I couldn't thank him even if I did.
Anywhere. God is spirit. And the time is coming and is now here that it won't matter where you worship, but only that you do it in spirit and truth. Heart and mind, that is the kind of worshiper he's looking for. It won't matter where you're from or what you've done. Do you believe what I'm telling you?
Until the Messiah comes and explains everything and sorts this mess out, including me, I don't trust in anyone.
You're wrong when you say that you've never received anything from God. This Messiah you speak of, I am he. The first one was named Ramin. You were a woman of purity who was excited to be married. But he wasn't a good man. He hurt you. And it made you question marriage and even the practice of your faith.
Stop it.
The second was Farzad. On your wedding night, his skin smelled like oranges. And to this day, every time you pass by the oranges in the market, you feel guilty for leaving him. Because he was the only truly godly man you've been with. But you felt unworthy.
Why are you doing this?
I have not revealed myself to the public as the Messiah. You are the first. It would be good if you believed me.
You picked the wrong person.
I came to Samaria just to meet you. Do you think it's an accident that I'm here in the middle of the day?
I am rejected by others.
I know. But not by the Messiah.
And you know these things. Because you are the Christ. I'm going to tell everyone.
I was counting on it.
Spirit and truth.
Spirit and truth.
It won't be all about mountains or temples.
Soon, just the heart.
You promise?
I promise.
This man told me everything I've done. Oh, he must be the Christ!
Hey, wait!
Your water!
You forgot your
Fancy, a man who told me everything I ever did!
What really jumped out to me as I read this text again in preparation for this message and as I watched this interaction that you just have, as this woman is talking with Jesus about how many barriers existed between her and God. Barriers that others had put up, barriers that she had put up, barriers that she just believed existed. And I want you to just think about this for a moment. She referenced and experienced ethnic barriers. Something that was mentioned in the text and in the interaction here that you may not know was that Jews and Samaritans ethnically were separated from each other. Even geographically, they lived apart from each other. Ancestrally, they had been connected, but then over time that had drifted. And there was a lot of animosity and acrimony and ethnic tensions and racism between them, and particularly Jews towards Samaritans. And she even references that, you know, Jews had this idea that to be clean, you wouldn't even share or touch a vessel that a Samaritan had used. And so this whole idea of like, oh, give me a drink from your jar. She was like, what? This has not happened. There's a barrier here. Certainly, she just felt it between her and Jesus, even before she knew who Jesus was. She just knew he was a Jewish man, and there was an ethnic barrier. But there was also barriers between her and God of shame and judgment about things that she had done. Some of her life that she was trying to hide, and she even says, well, that's why I'm here at a well in the middle of the day, so I don't have to deal with that. I don't have to talk to people. The shame that I feel, the shame that others have put on me, the judgment that I feel from others. And she doesn't even go into the details, but you can see initially in the conversation that is creating barriers, not only between her and other people, but her and religious institutions, her and religious holy people, and her and God. There were barriers of gender. She referenced that and in the ancient Near East and certainly in the Greco-Roman first century, not just confined to Jews and Samaritans, but in a sense, the whole Greco-Roman culture in those days, men were considered far more superior than women. In a sense, women were in the category almost of property with women, with children. And a woman's value was her ability to run a home and bear children and all of that kind of stuff. But ultimately, that was the only value she was seen to have in that society. And that spilled over into religious circles and into religious places where the priority would have been given to men and older men. And even spaces in the Jewish temple at that time would have been separated for women and men. And she obviously felt that in her world as a Samaritan. And so there were barriers of gender, in a sense, that separated her. And she noted, well, you're whoever you are, you probably shouldn't even be talking to me. There were barriers of historical wounds and grudges. You know, she references old arguments and old grudges and wounds and things that she had felt others had used against her to push her away and separate her and tell her that she couldn't worship God in a certain way. And so there was wounds. This wasn't just an intellectual dialogue for her. You could tell there was history. People have beef over history, and there were grudges around family and tribe and ethnicity. And then, of course, the barriers of the details of religion. She was well aware of what the rules were and who could and who couldn't and where not and all of that. And she gets into this dialogue with Jesus and she seems very amped up about it and very aware of how all this is supposed to work and where that left her, in a sense, on the outs and in a marginalized situation. Ethnic barriers, barriers of shame and judgment, barriers of gender, barriers of historical wounds and grudges, and barriers of the details of religion. Friends, think about this with me for a moment. Nothing has changed, has it? I mean, these are still all of the barriers that many people put in place or feel others have put in place or they just perceive are there that separate them from God. The ethnic barriers that people feel like certain cultures and certain people groups have more access to religion or to God, or if I was born in this place and not that place, people feel a distance, or people somehow feel because of their skin color and the way certain people who held religious power have communicated that, and certainly the history in our continent, in our country, would have communicated that. There'd be certain people because of their ethnic background, because of their skin color, because of where they live, would have felt that God was against them, that God was judging them. There are barriers of shame and judgment that people continue to put up that a lot of people don't even want to come to a place of church. What kind of church is it? And in fact, it's one of the things that makes me so proud of and my heart breaks about our church is that people will say, or about the church, that people will say about our church when they find it, oh yeah, it's a really non-judgmental church, as if that needs to be qualified, which apparently it does, because people feel that in ways that put barriers, not just between them and churches, but between them and God. There are barriers of gender. In a sense, many ways, in many religions across the board, men are still favored. Women at times and in different ways, and sometimes very overtly in separate spaces or roles that women can and can't have, or sometimes just implied that often women feel like second-class citizens when it comes to faith or in religious communities. There are barriers of historical wounds. How many of us have church hurt? Stuff from the past or stuff from our families, or maybe we weren't even brought up in the church, going to church. We were for a period of time. I've heard this so many times where people said it was a period of time and then my parents went through something and the church wasn't there for them, or the religious community judged them, or the religious community kicked them out. And then as a kid, you just stopped going and you knew there was hurt, and that's a grudge, or that's a wound, or that's a scar that's still with you or still with some of the people around you that has put a barrier between them and God. And then, of course, all the details of religion, what you have to do and can't do and where this belongs and what's the right place of worship and what's the thing you should say and do and pray and all of those things, many of which don't feel like guiding lights, but actually walls that are being built up between us and God. I think if we're honest, friends, we'll say, man, this seems to be the way of life and people and religion and faith. So many barriers. And in this conversation, Jesus is offering her, you know, ironically, they're at a well, right? And he's offering her this life-giving, life-changing relationship with him. And all she can see is the barriers that exist between her and being able to say yes to that. Friends, this is actually why we started the church 20 years ago. I say this often, but in my experience, and as we began to talk as a community who were planting this, and we've talked continually over the years, my conviction, my belief, and my experience as I talk to other people is many, many, many people have walked away from a Jesus they have never met because of all of the barriers that others, and including the church, have put up. Many people have walked away from a Jesus they've never met because of the church, because of religion. And so what if we said 20 years ago, we could start a church, not built with perfect people, but with people who were really wanting to put, in a sense, Jesus at the center, to somehow help people have an encounter, a life-changing, life-giving relationship with Jesus. What if we could do that? And we were motivated to that. But I'll be honest with you, it was way harder than I thought it was going to be. Much harder than I thought it was going to be. I knew there were barriers. I just didn't know how high and wide and deep they were and how hard it would be for people to say yes or to even see Jesus. And I've said this to you many times before, but in our neighborhood, we realized people who we knew, that Jen and I knew, who trusted us enough to babysit their kids, but they would never come to our church. In fact, even as I mentioned the word church, it was like this gargoyle shadow had come up behind me and their eyes glazed over and they slowly backed away or something like that. The barriers just right away from the word or from the very profession eventually that I ended up having. I remember inviting people to church over the years and they would say, well, you know, can anyone come? And I'd say, yes. And they're like, but I'm Jewish. And I'm like, well, yes, you can come, but I'm Muslim. Yes, it could come. What do I have to wear? You know, which is a totally understandable question. But what it's communicating is you can't come as you are. Certain clothes, certain spaces, don't be underdressed, don't be out of place. And then maybe the one that would break my heart the most is, how much does it cost to come? These are all of the barriers that people would articulate that existed between them and the church. And so we realized, man, we want to create a place where people can come and actually meet God, but there are so many walls. During my master's reading that took me 10 years to complete as I became a pastor and tried to get educated somewhat for it, I remember reading a book in one of my classes one day, and I remember coming across a paragraph that leapt off the page to me. Really, it hit me between the eyes, and it put into words something that had been so deep in my own heart and something that I was feeling like, yes, this is what it means for us to be the church. This is what we're trying to do. And I want to read it for you. It's from a book called The Shaping of Things to Come by Michael Frost and Alan Hirsch. In some farming communities, the farmers might build fences around their properties to keep their livestock in and the livestock of neighboring farms out. But in rural communities where farms or ranches cover an enormous geographic area, fencing the property is out of the question. In our home of Australia, ranches, called stations, are so vast that fences are superfluous. They don't do anything. Under these conditions, a farmer has to sink a bore and create a well. a precious water supply in the outback. It is assumed that livestock, though they will stray, will never roam too far from the well, lest they die. As long as there is a supply of clean water, the livestock will remain close by. They go on to say in this book how easy and natural and seemingly instinctive it is for us as religious people or religious communities or faith communities or whatever you want to call it, to live by fences, to think about the fence, to set up fences. Who's in, who's out? What's the behavior that gets you in? What's the behavior that keeps you in? What's the behavior that will keep you out? What's the behavior that will kick you out if you were in? That it's so easy for us, not even just actually in religion and faith, but like in every community, what's the behaviors? What's the, who's in, who's out? But definitely in religious and faith communities. The thing that the focus is on what the fences are. Where's the right place of worship? How to pray? What to do? What not to do? What to say? What not to say, how to live, where were you born, and all of this kind of stuff. Very clear focus on the fences so we really know who's in and who's out. How do you get in? How do you stay in? And what might you do that would disqualify you or kick you out? And in the end, of course, all that fences end up producing are shame and inferiority. If you feel like you're outside and can't get in, or you were inside and now you're disqualified and kicked out, or judgmental attitudes and superiority towards others. Look at me, this is what I've done, because the focus is on what qualifies me to be in, what lets me stay in, what makes me different from you, and I'm not like you, and that's why you're out and I'm in. This is what fences inevitably produce. And apparently, from the conversation with Jesus and this woman, nothing's changed for 2,000 years. This is how people see. These are all of the barriers, the fences that exist between us and God. And it's amazing in this conversation, right? Jesus, as he's talking to her systematically, is taking every single fence post down. As she raises this, as she raises that, he addresses it. He addresses it gently, persistently, firmly, intentionally, one by one, taking down all the barriers that she believed existed between her and God, all of the barriers that other people had put up between her and God, all of the barriers that she was living by and behind, all of the ways that had kept her outside and removed and distant from this life-giving, life-changing relationship with God. And Jesus systematically takes them down until all that's left is her standing in front of him, realizing, this is the one. And he is offering me a life-giving, life-changing relationship. And now, if I'm honest, I'm just afraid. You know, as destructive as fences are in communities, I think this is why we gravitate towards them as people. Because we're in control. When there are fences and behaviors and lists and things that we can say, it's this is the stuff you do, this is the stuff you don't do, this is what qualifies you, this is what disqualifies you, this is who's in, this is who's out. It's very clear. We are in control. We can see the fence. We can manage the fence. We can set up the fence. We can manage our behaviors to make sure we're inside and not outside. And Jesus takes it all down as he's talking to this woman. And now she's not in control anymore. Now she's afraid because now she realizes the only thing separating her from a life-giving, life-changing relationship with God is her own fear. And the invitation is clearly given to her. Friends, this is the beauty of being able to build a community that is not marked by fences at the perimeter, but by a well at the center. The beauty of a community that looks less at what are the behaviors and what are the beliefs, if you were, even the creeds and the things you have to say and not say and do and not do and who's in and who's out, and gets rid of this idea of insiders and outsiders altogether, and simply everybody communally looking together towards the center and moving towards the life-giving, life-changing, living water that is at the center of our community. That's the beauty of creating a community like that, that it is a journey we're on together. It's why we called ourselves the Well. That we wanted to be a community, not marked by an emphasis on who's in and who's out and what the behaviors are at the perimeter, but actually saying, no, all of us together are moving towards Jesus at the center. What does it mean to build a community and to be a church that ultimately is about our collective journey over and over and over and over to the life-giving, life-changing center that is Jesus. This is not a one-time thing where you get baptized and you're in, or you do this and you're out, but it is an ongoing, evergreen, never-stopping journey collectively of going back to the well over and over and over again to have our thirst for life and forgiveness and grace and meaning and purpose and love quenched by the life-giving, life-changing water that Jesus offers. Friends, this isn't just what we need. This is what our world needs. Do you know why? Because the most dangerous kind of Christian, the most dangerous kind of church are people who claim to know God but haven't had a drink of the living water in years. People who don't even know they're thirsty. People who don't think they need anything. They're in. People who aren't actually having a life-giving, life-changing relationship with Jesus, they just say they're a Christian or they go to church. That is the most dangerous kind of Christian and dangerous kind of church because it has the perception of life and faith, but no reality of it at all. Their lives aren't being changed. They don't even know they're thirsty. See, a community that puts a well at the center, Jesus at the center, knows what Jesus went on to say a little while later in this biography in John, that his invitation was to everyone, where one day in the temple, Jesus stands up and says, if anyone who is thirsty, anyone is thirsty, let them come and drink. Jesus' invitation is to everyone. This isn't about the insiders who have already achieved it. I got baptized, so I'm in. I prayed the prayer, so I'm in. I live this way, so now I get to stay in, and you need to do this in order to get in. It's like, no, we're all thirsty people. Let's go over and over and over again to receive the life-giving, life-changing, living water that Jesus gives us. And so I'd invite you, this is your first day at the well, or first day in a long time, or if this is home for you, if you've been a part of this church for a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years or 15 or 20, my invitation for all of you based on this is to ask yourself, am I thirsty? And when was the last time I had a good drink? Am I thirsty? This is the only requirement. There is no fence, but there is a well. His name is Jesus, and he offers living water to every one of us. Am I thirsty? Do I realize my need for him every day? And when was the last time I went to him to receive life and strength and grace and purpose and love? Friends, everything we do as a church, whether it's our weekly celebration on Sundays, encouraging you to join home groups or to serve on teams or to work with our kids or set up and tear down or be part of our hospitality teams, to read scripture together as we do our daily reading, to live on mission, to engage in personal practices of growing in prayer. All of those things, every single one of them is meant to help you move towards the well, towards Jesus, to have more of him in your life. He says, if anyone has that living water in me, streams of living water will flow from within them, to have that constant ongoing life. When Jesus talked about eternal life, he wasn't talking about heaven someday, one day. He was talking about life on the inside bubbling over like a spring of living water. And that's what he says to this woman. If you drink the water I give you, it will constantly quench your thirst because nothing else can. Am I thirsty? When was the last time I had a good drink? Ask yourself that and then ask yourself this. Who else around me is thirsty and needs to have some of this as well? Who else in my life can I invite to say, come with me? Just like that woman went and became, in a sense, the first message carrier of Jesus. Isn't it incredible that she was the first person that he literally said, I am who I am? Like he revealed his identity to her. And then she did exactly what he hoped she would do, which is to tell everyone and come. And what was she doing? Saying, oh, I'm in. You should get it. He's like, no, I just got a drink of life-giving water. You should try this. Who else in your life is thirsty? As you are moving towards Jesus day after day after day, finding life in him, who can you say, you have to try this? Who else in your life is thirsty and needs a drink of this as well? Because here's the thing. the people in your life, your friends, your family, your neighbors, the people on your sports team, your classmates. They're not going to meet Jesus in person at a well. They're going to meet you. They're going to meet you at the tryout for your kid's baseball team. They're going to meet you on the first day of class when they're sitting next to you. They're going to meet you in the new job that you just got into. They're going to meet you on the next corporate retreat. They're going to meet you when you go out to mow your lawn this week. They're going to meet you the place where you normally go, your local watering hole where you go for a burger or a beer every week. They're going to meet you. And when they do, you have an opportunity to help tear down the fences that they think exist between them and a life-giving, life-changing relationship with the living God. You have an opportunity to take those down so that they can see and know who Jesus really is.